When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to episode 133 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Last month, the Alabama Supreme Court ruled that three couples who had frozen embryos accidentally destroyed in a storage facility could pursue wrongful death lawsuits. After the ruling, three major providers of in vitro fertilization paused those services in the state because of concerns about civil liability. As of this recording, Alabama lawmakers are looking to pass protections so fertility clinics can resume IVF services. One thing I learned interestingly in preparing for this episode was that nationally, IVF accounts for just about 2% of all births. Rick, this Alabama legal case is just one of many which look at one of the most fundamental questions we face. Does knowing how life was formed tell us anything about the meaning of life? As a ethics and philosophy expert, I think you're the perfect person to pose that question to.
Yeah, it certainly puts pressure on what we will do with regard to life, which reflects our values, the kind of values that we place on it. So, for example, one of the things that IVF does is it really does force couples who are engaging in a procedure like this to question how much, I was going to say, like, how much they really want a child. It's not so much that, but, like, does it matter to them that many more embryos are created than will likely be used, like that sort of thing? And in a way in which, like, natural reproduction, you don't really have to think about it. In a way, it just happens. In fact, there's a lot of pregnancies that are result from mistakes that are never intended, but they just happen. IVF is a very intentional process. That's the whole point of it.
And expensive.
And so it's a very deliberate thing. But then you have to reconcile these unintended consequences. Part of the intention isn't to create a bunch of frozen embryos that then just remain frozen indefinitely. That's not the aim of it, but that goes along with it, right? And then there's the other embryos that, you know, that fail to implant, which is, you know, maybe, you know, 70 to 50% of them, that there's a pretty high rate of unsuccessful implantation with the embryos. And so it forces us to ask these questions about the meaning of life that I think we could otherwise go throughout life without really facing directly.
You know, this procedure started in the 1970s, and it was when the first baby was born using this procedure. But it certainly took a while to ramp up to, as I said, now being responsible for about 2% of all births in the United States. But it's interesting, looking back on some of the reporting decades ago when this was starting to become part of the national conversation, is there was a portion of Americans, and often ones that were religious, but not maybe entirely, who were, their position against this was simply, well, if as a couple or whatever the situation is, you're unable to naturally have children, that this procedure is sort of meddling in the natural process. And that for some people was sort of the beginning and end of the conversation, that this is something that we just shouldn't be doing because, I may oversimplify it by saying, because that's not what God intended, but maybe that's what some people thought. It doesn't seem like those same concerns are as prevalent today as they were a generation or two ago. What are your thoughts?
Well, that's been a large part of the official Catholic Church objection to IVF. There's a few different parts to it. Well, one is the fact that it creates an embryo that is a kind of uniquely identifiable human being that then is, many of them are destroyed, so equivalent to abortion, or creates, it is in a way, it's not intended to destroy embryos in the way that abortion is, but it has that effect. And so that's one objection of the Catholic Church. But the other is that it's, quote, it separates reproduction from the marital act. That is, so it's an artificial means of reproduction. And the Catholic Church has, I mean, I think to their credit, been really consistent over the years in saying, like, marriage must always be open to reproduction. So that's been their objection to contraception, for example, right? Not that it creates abortion or destroys embryo, just that it means you're separating sex from marriage, and it has a different kind of purpose than the purpose of sex is reproduction, or at least being open to reproduction. That has largely gone out of favor, even among most Catholics. I mean,
yes.
You know, when I was a kid, you kind of knew who the Catholic families were in town because most of them had, you know, 7, 8, 10 kids. You know, they were really large Catholic families. And that was different than the Protestant families, who were much more likely to have 2 or 3 or maybe 4 kids. And now, you know, Catholic families seem to be about the same size as most Protestant families. You know, contraception, although still not recognized by the church, is still widely practiced among many Catholics. And so that this objection is still kind of official Catholic position, but you don't hear about it as much. And it's what's happened instead is the kind of the Protestant view. As far as a religious view of IVF, it's become more dominated by the Protestant view, which is just, well, it's life-affirming instead of life-taking. And so it's not equivalent to abortion because IVF is life-affirming.
And in the response to the court ruling in Alabama, you know, I think any Democrat who was talking about it came down on the side of IVF is a good thing. But it was interesting that a significant number of Republicans also spoke out in favor of IVF. So this is one of those issues that seems to have a fairly broad base of support. Because of that, were you surprised that, I mean, I guess I was surprised that this issue, which I frankly don't think about a lot, sort of showed up on the front pages of newspapers and led TV news episodes late last month. I sort of thought this was like, we were done with this, that this was sort of like in the past. Were you surprised that this is suddenly a topic of conversation again? And I guess, secondly, and maybe more to the point of our topic today, setting aside whether you agree with the ruling in Alabama, do you think it's occasionally good to have conversations about things that are pretty important like this?
I'm not surprised. And yes, I do think it's good. I mean, this is kind of what, like, people like me who, like, this is my job, is ethical controversies and talking about them and teaching about them. I welcome times where people start paying attention to what are the real consequences of our actions and actually having discussion about, because this is something that I've talked to a number of couples who were considering IVF and talked to them about it. And this is something that was kind of a surprise to many of them, like really what the whole process involves. Whereas I think because it's a small percentage of people, a lot of people don't really realize like what happens with IVF. And so it was entirely predictable that when you have laws on the books, like the Alabama laws that say that prohibit the destruction of an embryo, and the law doesn't specify whether the embryo is in the womb or outside the womb, right? That the Alabama Supreme Court would look at that and say, well, the law doesn't specify, therefore, you know, a frozen embryo is an embryo. It's a destruct. Then it's a if you destroy it, it's a destruction of a human being.
And just to pause on that for a second, because I think people often sort of do get confused on these issues too. Obviously, Alabama is a conservative state. That's not a secret. But the reason the court decided what it did was because of how it interpreted Alabama state law. There's one easy way to fix that, and it sounds like that's what state legislators there are trying to do right now, is to update the law so it does codify these principles more clearly, and then the court has no role to play. So,
yeah.
And I think that's probably what direction we're heading there, although we don't know that for sure.
We don't know that for sure, and I've been really disappointed in much of the commentary and the news coverage of this, because what you hear over and over again is the Alabama Supreme Court decided that IVF was an illegal procedure, and they didn't decide that at all. They just interpreted the law, which actually is fairly clear. It didn't require much interpretation. They just said it says what it says. And if the Alabama, the state of Alabama wants the law to be different, they can always change the law. They just have to specify what the law is.
Well,
and that's what they're in the process of doing. It's not easy, though, because you have the pro-life movement, which is, you know, many of the pro-life activists for a long time have said that's exactly right. And within the kind of the hardcore of the pro-life movement has been a strong resistance to IVF. It's popularly supported, but it's not within the pro-life movement.
And like so many of these social issues that bubble up from time to time, that one of the reasons I think people's attitudes on this change and evolve over the years is when you know someone who has gone through this or benefited from it. I know someone who is she's probably getting close to 40, I would imagine. 4 or 5 years ago, she was single, was dating, never could quite find the right guy, but she really wanted to be a mom. And so she went this route, and from everything I can tell, she has been and continues to be a great mother. She has a child that seems remarkably well adjusted. And you see stories like that, and you're thinking, well, my goodness, had it not been for this procedure, this friend's life would be not as fulfilling, not as happy as it is now. And oh, by the way, this what seems to be a wonderful young girl would simply not be here. And you hear stories like that, and you're like, well, goodness, thank goodness this exists. At the same time, I'm also convinced that if the preponderance of people who took advantage of these services were fitting my friend's profile, who were single women who just, again, couldn't find the right man to have a relationship with, I think it would probably be less popular, because I think the majority of the people who use this are married couples, and there's been in the news recently a number of kind of high-profile people who have talked about how this has played a role in their lives. Mike Pence and his wife, for example, hardly radical lefties, talked on a very personal level about how IVF has helped them in their lives. So it's just interesting how it affects different segments of our society differently. And of course, as well, I'm confident, for reasons we all understand, that there are many gay and lesbian couples who have used IVF to start families. So I just think a little of this depends on who you know who has benefited from these services, and also what you think about some of these groups who have benefited from these services.
And I want to make clear that, you know, I teach ethics at a Catholic university. I usually don't teach this subject, and I don't teach what we Catholic ethics. I teach a regular, courses tend to be more business ethics, that sort of thing. And as a Protestant, I'm not bound to the church's teaching the way that, that Catholics within my institution might be. I welcome the church's teaching on this because I think it brings a kind of clarity to the issues, and it tries to do it out of tradition. I'm not convinced that the point at which we say an individual human life starts is right at fertilization. There's a really strong argument to be made. This is, by the way, it's not really a theological argument. It's a scientific one, that this is the point at which you have a being with its own genetic identity. That's the kind of claim there. On the other hand, you have to recognize that in natural reproduction, there's a fairly large percentage of fertilized eggs that never are implanted, right? And so, you have to say, well, the natural reproduction process, there's a lot of, you could call them spontaneous abortions, but they're not really abortions. They're failures to implant. And so, there's a lot of fertilized eggs that end up dying, right? In the natural process, the IVF increases that percentage somewhat, but it's not, by orders of magnitude. It just increases what is already a natural occurrence. A greater concern that I find that I really appreciate in the Catholic teaching about this is a warning against what they call the commodification of the human being, and this is making the production of human beings a commercial transaction rather than a result of a loving relationship. This first really came home to me. I was a grad student at Johns Hopkins, and I was looking through the student newspaper. I came across this classified ad where somebody was advertising for an egg donor, and he had very specific requirements. He was willing to pay a great deal of money, but he wanted a young woman, and he specified an age, and I think it was between 20 and 25 years old, who was blonde and blue-eyed, who was tall, I think he specified over 5'10", who was on an athletic team, had an SAT or ACT of a certain number. He had all these requirements. And then the amount of money he was willing to spend for an egg donor or somebody who meet these requirements. This is a great example of the commodification of reproduction. And it occurred to me, what if he purchases this egg and has an IVF procedure done, and the baby turns out not to meet his expectations? Is he disappointed that he didn't get what he purchased? Or is the child somebody that he loves no matter what? Now, this can happen in any condition. It doesn't happen just from a commercial transaction. I mean, it's possible for parents not to love their children for any variety of reasons. And yet, I think it's a real concern that as we develop more and more technology, that all kinds of important relationships in our lives become seen through the lens of commercial transaction rather than kind of natural human relationships. This is where I think a religious perspective really comes into this. What is the grounding of this idea that every human being has dignity and has inestimable worth? This is a kind of religious perspective on the human being. If you have this perspective, if you take it really seriously, does that mean certain modes of reproduction are no longer options to us? I'm not so sure, but I think that's what the Catholic view is getting at, and this is what I see people not really taking this quite seriously enough when they're praising IVF. I think because IVF is kind of the test case of how we regard our children.
So I want to pause on that for a second, So if I'm misquoting you a little bit here, please correct me. But I think I've heard you talk about in the past, when you and your wife were young, and I think maybe had young kids, you moved around to a couple different cities. I know you lived in Baltimore for a while. I know you lived in Memphis for a while. I don't know again where if your children were born at those points or not. But I think I've heard you talk about when you decided to move to La Crosse and take the job at Viterbo University. You looked at not only the university, I'm sure, and what it could offer you professionally, but you also looked at La Crosse as a city and said, is this a good place to raise children? And I think I even remember you talking about how you chose your neighborhood that you lived in, kind of as, you know, you're making the best guess you can coming new to a city, but saying this seems like a place where I'd want to raise kids, and this would give them maybe a chance to be more successful here and a better upbringing than living somewhere else that you may have been. Does that seem right?
That's pretty much right. Yep.
So explain to me then, from an ethical standpoint, how making those decisions that you are, again, not guarantees, but hopeful that you're steering your family into the right direction, is different than saying, when I'm looking for a egg donor, I want to make sure that she is, you know, has a clean, relatively clean health history, seems to be intelligent, seems to have lots of different positive traits, because just like living in a neighborhood like you do in a city in which you live, that may help your children thrive, giving them sort of a early head start on the DNA side also can help. Why are those things different?
I think that's a good point. I'm not sure they are entirely different, because of course the purchasing of a house in a particular neighborhood is a commercial transaction. And so I don't think that they are completely different. And one of the things that, you know, when I mentioned about this, like the IVF is kind of it puts pressure on this idea of whether we're treating a child as a commodity or not, or as a product of, say, a loving relationship. I think it puts pressure on the idea, but it doesn't determine it. And I know children that have been born through IVF that were deeply loved, and who are really, you know, great kids from parents who love them and sacrifice for them. And so I'm not saying that IVF is incompatible with the proper attitude and upbringing of children. I'm not saying that at all. What I was trying to do is articulate how the Catholic Church is, as far as I know, it's the only kind of consistent place where we find these warnings about like the increasing commodification of life that slowly erodes this idea of human life having inherent worth or inherent dignity. And I don't think it is necessarily incompatible with that idea. I think it just, it kind of slightly erodes it. And so I have to say, I'm not sure where I stand with regard to IVF. I mean, because when I talk to people who've chosen that route, it's not that they are bad people. I just wonder, sometimes I wonder if they know what they're getting into, if they've asked all the questions they should be asking. And I welcome what's happened with the court decision in Alabama, because I think it opens us up to the very kind of conversation we're having right now of, first of all, saying, well, what actually happens in this process? Now, one thing that happens in the process, by the way, is that we are not, for example, seeing news stories of quintuplets being born on a regular basis, right? As we, in the early days of IVF, we were seeing a lot more of that. And I think the process has improved somewhat. So the question is, like, what's the objection to it? Is it two main objections? One is that it I think it necessarily involves the destruction of a fertilized egg. The other is that it necessarily, in a way, intentionally involves that. And the other is that it's an artificial technological means of reproduction. And those are the two big moral objections to it. Are they decisive objections? I really don't know. I mean, I think they're serious. Are they decisive? The Catholic view is that they're decisive, right? And the Catholic view has been what has really driven, in many respects, driven the pro-life movement. So this is what we're going to see a battle over, probably kind of carried out publicly in the Alabama legislature, is this battle between like these moral convictions of the pro-life movement versus what even most, I would say, Republican voters actually believe, which is not in line with the pro-life view.
Whether one agrees or disagrees with the Catholic Church on issues like abortion and in vitro fertilization and birth control, I would say I give them credit for having a consistent message on all three of those, that they've sort of drawn a line in the sand and said these things are all on the wrong side of it. Do you think those three things are all fairly related, and do you think people are hypocritical to say, like, well, I'll pick on the Pences? I mean, I don't know them personally, but they have spoken out quite consistently in favor of IVF, and and at least Mike, and I assume his wife too, have spoken out very consistently against abortion. Is there a contradiction there ethically? Yes, and I would throw in again contraception. I think if there is one thing, obviously IVF affects a narrow sliver of our population. Birth control is not a narrow sliver of our population, and that is, I would imagine, the teaching that most Catholics probably disagree with most from the church's doctrine. Do you think it's okay for people to sort of pick what works for them? Or do you think you sort of have to say, I'm all in with the traditional Catholic teachings, or I'm all opposed to them? Because, again, it seems like at least their message is consistent.
And I'm in favor of consistency. And I think that many people, I would say probably the Pences, or maybe not, I don't know all of what the Pences' views are, but many people like them who have happily gone along with an opposition to abortion on the grounds that life begins at conception, which you hear quite a bit, and then say, oh, but that doesn't apply to people like us who are using IVF. Because, I mean, if that's your view, like, well, then it applies with IVF too. Like, if you think that, well, human life really begins at implantation, like, that's a different kind of view, then that would be consistent with, say, opposing abortion, but still allowing for IVF. But you don't hear that within the pro-life movement. You don't hear people saying life begins at implantation. I think some people have argued for that. I mean, that's a harder place to draw the line. The question is, I think that this is where I would say there's that inconsistency among many pro-life Republicans, especially Protestants, is that they have not noticed, or at least overlooked, the way in which IVF is compatible with their stated opposition to abortion. I would say there's another kind of inconsistency among many pro-choice Democrats, in that they refuse to draw any kind of line, even though they think some kind of line must be drawn. They just won't state where that line should be drawn. And you have to draw a line somewhere, because what we're talking about is, you can't just say that it's completely up to the mother, because we're talking about the creation of an independent being. And at some point, you know, like babies are vulnerable. So are fetuses. And at what point do vulnerable beings need the protection of the state? And you have to draw the line somewhere. And I find that a lot of pro-choice Democrats don't really want to have a sincere discussion about where you even draw the line.
And when you say draw the line, you mean legally, because, you know, the Catholic Church, although is a powerful institution and affects the lives of millions around the world, it doesn't have it doesn't have the law behind it. And then that's where it gets tricky, I suppose, is, you know, I don't think any serious person says the Catholic Church should not be permitted to share its views on these topics. I think we live in a society where any organization or person should be able to share views on the topics of the day. Of course, where it gets tricky is when you turn those ideas or what they might even consider to be ethical markers into laws of the land. And that's really where this gets tricky. And that's the stuff that we've been, those topics we've been debating in this country for, gosh, probably 100 years now, right?
Yeah. Well, many of our laws, we decide on what the law should be based on our ethical views of things. And so that's what the Catholic Church is putting forward. And that's why they've been very, you know, zealous in urging people, urging members of the church to vote for pro-life candidates because of their view that the law should reflect certain like core ethical convictions. And one is like the protection of the unborn, and the protection of the vulnerable. So of course the Catholic Church can't decide on what the law will be, but they can say, well, we can decide like what laws would be just. And I think that's been a failure of the Democrats, and it's come to light since the Dobbs decision, that we have, you know, we have European countries with much more stringent laws regarding abortion than we now have in many democratically run states. There has to be a line drawn at some point. It just, like, it's been very difficult right now to get any kind of social consensus on where that should be.
You mentioned earlier that you think consistency is important, and I just was made me think about, and this has been the case for a while now, where we have discussions about where to draw that line, but at the same time, in the criminal law, the death of a fetus can often lead to criminal charges. You know, if there's, for example, if there's a case where a pregnant woman will say she's 4 months pregnant, is out driving down the road, minding her own business, and a drunk driver comes and hits her car, and the woman is injured but survives, but her unborn baby dies, well, that driver faces significant charges because, again, assuming that this woman's plan and was to take this baby to full term. At the same time, she could be, and again, this sounds a little hyperbolic, but she could have been driving to the abortion clinic that afternoon to abort that fetus, and that would, in many states, be just fine. Is that seem like a problem to you?
Yeah, it does seem like a problem to me, and it's why I come down on the pro-life side of this. I mean, I think when a pregnant woman is talking about her baby and feeling her baby kick at a very young age, I mean, there's a reason that you often will find a woman talking about her baby, not her fetus.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, even though it's in the womb, it's her child. And I think It's a coherent way of speaking, and I think it makes sense for our laws to reflect that way. I've been pretty clear. I would hope that eventually what we do in our country is reach some kind of compromise position legally with regard to abortion laws that more reflects what's happened in Europe, where there are some restrictions in abortion after a certain period, say 12 weeks, something like that. I don't think it's workable given right now, like what the widespread views are, that we would have prohibitions against abortion anytime after conception. So I realize that like our legal structure might not be the same as what I think is morally right, but that's okay. I mean, there's all kinds of situations like that where our laws do not reflect convictions, where those convictions aren't shared by a majority of people. That's why you have, in a democracy, you have compromises on these things.
Before we close on this topic, I felt like this was as good of an episode of any to ask this question, because we're talking about some pretty fundamental issues that about when life begins. And, you know, it seems kind of cliche, but one of the most fundamental philosophical questions that I'm sure you must get asked from time to time is, what is the meaning of life, right? I mean, that is sort of the top level philosophical debate that one has. And I can't believe for a minute that nobody's asked your opinion on that. When asked, how do you answer?
It's surprising, you know, for somebody who's a philosopher. There's a lot of people know I'm a philosopher. I hardly ever get asked that question. And I kind of think that's because everybody knows there's not a simple answer to the question.
They don't want to hear you drone on for 20 minutes.
Exactly. So I'm not going to do that. But I will say this. I think we find the meaning of life in two dimensions. And I think of it vertically and horizontally. So vertically is depth. This is what we talk about. Like we find certain experiences to be quite deep. And these are experiences often of beauty or goodness, where we find ourselves really moved by some experience. And then there's the experience of depth or of breadth, where we go out, we have different kinds of experiences that we do through travel, which we talked about on a recent episode, where we get to see more of the world, where we meet new people and have interesting experiences and conversations with them. And I think we find meaning in both ways. So it's kind of depth of experience and a kind of breadth of experience. And what both of them do is they expand our soul. They enlarge in our soul. I think we find the meaning of life in the growth of the soul and along those two dimensions. So that's my sub 20-minute answer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma, and Rick, here is my question for you. Now, I'll preface this by saying many of my dilemmas that I present are things I've encountered in my everyday life. This is not one of those things. This was something I found on Twitter a couple of weeks ago that was sort of making the rounds through different feeds, and people had lots of different opinions on it. I was curious yours. It was based on a wedding invitation that was sent out. I don't even know whose wedding. There's no names on the on this version that I have. But I'll just read you the invitation, and I'll be curious your reaction to it.
Okay.
We are overjoyed to extend our heartfelt invitation to you to join us on our special day as we celebrate our love and commitment. Your presence means the world to us. In lieu of traditional wedding gifts, we kindly request that you contribute toward the cost of our reception buffet. This will allow us to share a wonderful meal together and create lasting memories with our loved ones. The cost per adult is $40, and for children younger than 12, it's $20. To facilitate the planning process, we kindly ask that you include your contribution when you RSVP. This will help us provide accurate numbers to our venue and ensure a seamless experience for everyone. Please note that payment can be made through transferring the funds directly to our bank account at your earliest convenience, and then they list their banking account information. Kindly include your name and wedding buffet contribution in the payment reference. Your presence at our wedding is the most meaningful gift we could ask for, and we are truly grateful for your love and support as we embark on this new chapter of our lives together. Rick, if that invitation showed up in your mailbox, what would your reaction be?
My first reaction is it seems pretty tacky. That's just my gut reaction thinking about right now. But let me step back a bit. So it seems tacky because this is not normally what you do. Usually at a wedding reception, you want to invite guests and honor, in a way you're kind of honoring the guests and you're inviting them to share in this celebration. You wouldn't charge guests to come to your child's birthday party, although maybe some people do that, but if they have destination birthday parties for kids, maybe they do that. Here's what I would say is that's just a social convention. There's nothing, I don't think there's anything morally wrong with asking people to pay their way. And given how expensive weddings have become, and I know that many couples delay getting married for quite a while because of the cost of the wedding, they're saving, right, for wedding mm-hmm. expenses. This would allow a couple doing it this way to get married sooner and to invite more people instead of making a very small reception, have a larger reception with more people to participate. It seems tacky. Maybe that's kind of the way it's worded, but I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's just not the way it's usually done. And so I kind of wonder, is this something new that, have you looked into this, Scott? Is this something that more couples are doing?
I don't know the answer to that. My hunch is that maybe because, you know, like we've discussed, you know, people aren't always stuck in doing things they've always done. The other thing, too, I think that has changed over the years is because people aren't getting married at 19, 20 years old, that, you know, if you were married, like when my parents got married, they were 18 and 21. They had not lived together before marriage. They did not really have many things to start a home with. They didn't have pots and pans and dishes and towels and all the things that you sort of need and expect to start a house with. So this is, you know, in the olden days, that was sort of a great way to, you know, start your home. I mean, you know, I always joke that it seems like everybody of a certain age, when you go to a garage sale, has a punch bowl you can find, because I think like a punch bowl, although they're rarely used today, was like a really common wedding gift like 30, 40 years ago, when yep. people did things differently. So I would not be surprised to know this is going on more, because if you're getting married at a little bit older age, those traditional gifts aren't as useful. Now, I have a question for you on this too.
And I just wanted to say, you know, many years ago, it wasn't common. There weren't all these wedding facilities that charged a great deal for meals. A lot of receptions would be held, for example, in a church basement.
Well, okay.
They'd have volunteers cooking and serving and things like that. And so it wasn't a huge outlay to have a nice meal for a bunch of guests.
So I'm going to pause on that. I want to pause on that for a second. So let's say you get in your mailbox two separate invitations for summer. You know, this is about the time summertime wedding invitations will go out. And one of them is, and these people will just stipulate that you know about equally as well. And one of them has a reception just like you talked about in a church basement. And, you know, it, you just, you get the feel that this is not an extravagant affair, right? It's, it is exactly what you just described. And then the next day in the mail is an invitation to a reception that's being held at the country club. And, oh, and by the way, the invitation's just a little bit nicer designed and comes on, you know, they have those like embossed things that sometimes you get. And like the whole thing just feels more lavish. And maybe, I mean, obviously, if you're being invited, you know these people. And this doesn't surprise you, just knowing the background of these two couples. So the question then is, when you, and you plan to go to both of these, when you and your wife are shopping for a wedding gift, and you know that one is being held in a humble church basement and one is being held at the fancy country club on the edge of town, does that affect how much you spend on the gift you buy?
I don't think so.
Okay. Because I think in some people's eyes, there is sort of this like weird transactional thing that goes on is like, oh, well, this is obviously a expensive venue, so our gift better more closely represent the cost involved in this. And obviously it's not laid out as clearly as it is in the example I shared, but you might think, well, geez, this, you know, I just, this has got to be $100 a plate, so we better not, you know, cheap, but we better make sure we get them a nice gift. And whereas the church basement, you sort of instinctively know things are just, you know, yeah, kind of done on the cheap. And I think a lot of people, their gifts would reflect the expense involved. And I guess why I like, in some ways, the approach that this anonymous couple is taking is that they're just sort of laying out the facts. Here it is. Here's what the cost is. We'd love to have you there. What bothers me, I guess, is that they're like directing the funds to like their personal bank account, and I don't know how else you do that, but it does seem like a little more transactional.
Yeah, than... that's the tacky part.
Yeah.
Here's our bank account number, and you can transfer funds directly into it.
But at the same time, I mean, do you really want to say we'll have a big box at the end of the buffet line where you can stuff your money in? I mean, that doesn't the safest thing either.
Here's what I think I would prefer. You know, for many couples, as you point out, they don't really need a bunch of gifts to start their home together because they've got dishes and silverware and towels and all those things that used to be, you know, for when couples were getting married at a young age, they needed things to start the household. That's not what they need. The invitation that said, please don't give us gifts. However, mm-hmm. this wedding is quite expensive, and we would appreciate any donations that would help us to offset the costs so that we can invite as many friends as possible to join us on this day. And then just leave it open-ended, not asking mm-hmm. each person to spend $40 a meal, but just saying, if you'd like to contribute to offsetting these costs, that would really be appreciated, because that's what allows us to do this for lots of people that we want there to celebrate. I think something like that might be a little bit less tacky message. And I think I would respond really positively to something like that. Well, I'm thinking, yeah, of course I want to help with that expense.
And you're going to be dropping money one way or the other. So, I mean.
Right. But also just acknowledging, like, yeah, instead of just going through the registry and getting us something we don't really need anyway, just help us offset the cost of this reception.
So I had a relative who got married, oh gosh, probably 8-9 years ago. I don't know, some time ago. And this is also, they weren't the only people who did this. It was, and I'm sure it's still going on, but what they did, and I believe Iceland sticks in my mind, although I could be wrong, but I think their honeymoon was in Iceland, and they had like a list of things like tours or a meal or, you know, thing basically saying you can, you know, and it was, I think, on a website probably, where, you know, we're planning this, you know, wonderful honeymoon to this, you know, somewhat exotic place. If you'd like to contribute to any of these things that we'd like to do there, please do so. And I contributed in some way. I don't remember what exactly it was tied to, but maybe it was dinner at an interesting and neat restaurant in Reykjavik. So, I mean, like, to me, that, like, felt different somehow. And I was, like, more than happy to do that. But even though it was, like, a cash outlay, at least it was, like, and of course, you know, I was thinking this, and they kind of want you to think this, that, oh, gosh, when we go to that restaurant that night on our honeymoon, we'll think nice thoughts about the people who gave it to us. And that's, you know, perfectly good thing. So I to me, again, that didn't feel weird to me at all. But it's not all that different than what this is in some ways.
You know, I'm thinking back to the gifts we received following our wedding many, many years ago. The most memorable was a cooler. We received a cooler with a bottle of wine and a few other things, like everything we would need for a really fun picnic. That ended up being our most memorable gift because it was really an invitation to go out and have an experience. And we also received lots of towels, but we forgot all the people who sent us towels or gave us towels for a wedding. But we remember this couple that was really thoughtful. It wasn't anything that we had registered for or anything like that. It was really a thoughtfully assembled gift of all these things we would need for a nice picnic. And it was really wonderful. And so, like, that's what Cindy and I have tried to do is put together some kind of gift that might create a memorable experience like that for the new couple.
And I guess that's what if there is a problem with the invite we started this segment with, it is that there's no potential for things like that other than, well, we got 100 people to show up and it didn't cost us a lot of money and we were legitimately happy to see all of those people. But it's not like you can think back, and I bet you still remember who gave you that cooler, right? And that those kind of memories aren't there. But yeah, I think you're right. I think this is something that will continue to evolve. And I'll be curious to see the next wedding invitation I have, what it says.
Mm-hmm. And how much it's going to cost you.
And how much it's going to cost me. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe to The Ethical Life wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and that can be found on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.